Okay, go ahead and get started. Only announcement for the day. Hopefully not a surprise to anybody, but just want to remind you, midterm exam is going to be due on Friday, the beginning of class. Are there any questions on the midterm? Yeah.
So this is a clarifying question. I don't know if it would be number 2A, you say that the state may have a relationship between LCD and I1. Is that talking about a single equation or a single equation? Or what do you mean by relationship?
Talking, well, how it's worded, I guess, if you have a system of equations that only has those three variables and other constants in it, I guess I would grade that as full credit, but it's really talking about find one equation that relates these things, plus any other constants, but no other variables in there, bringing out of normalized form, obviously. Yeah. There's one other on problem one. In the description, somebody pointed out I say TO2. That should be TR2. There is no TO2 as it's labeled on the diagram. It's TR2. There is no TO2 anywhere, so I hope it hasn't thrown anybody off. But somewhere in that top paragraph, I have the wrong subscript on a variable. But in the same sentence where it talks about K, and K is labeled correctly, so I think it should be clear enough. But just in case anybody else noticed that. Anything else? Any other questions related to clarifications on midterm? Everybody done with it already? Piece of cake. Great. Glad to hear it. Okay. If not, we'll continue on. So last time we talked about this resonant switch identification and how by abstracting the high-frequency switch network from the parent PWM converter, we could immediately identify what type of resonant switch was employed. In this case, we looked at a flyback with a resonant switch, got rid of all the low-frequency behaviors, looked at just the high-frequency switch network, and found that it was a ZBS quasi-square wave. And then a forward converter, we found that it was a VCS quasi-resonant. And today, if we get through a little bit here on applications of high frequency and moving towards high frequency, we will employ this idea that really my resonant switch kind of stands alone. The behaviors of the parent PWM topology stay the same. All I'm doing is replacing the switch network behaviors to look at dynamic modeling. Then we went through, we looked at this ZBS multi-resonant buck. We didn't solve through it completely, but we kind of showed how you would go about using, in this case, three different state planes along with linear equations, normalizing them together and looking at the overall behaviors of the converter. Found that despite the complexity, there are some pretty advantageous characteristics of the ZBS multi-resonant buck, such as some range of conversion ratios for which I can maintain ZVS of all devices across the entire load range, zero power to full power, lower voltage stresses than I got in the ZVS quasi-resonant buck, but I kind of paid the price in terms of current stresses. So I want to take a second here and think about what happened with this multi-resonant converter. And this is the first case that we've looked at a parasitic element that kind of breaks up the behavior of what was my traditional half-bridge type switch network. So I no longer have this square wave being generated by a high side switch being on and a low side switch being on. And I'm in some way kind of decoupling my active switch from my passive switch, from my synchronous or rectifying switch. This multi-resonant converter, because it's integrated, kind of my dominant parasitics, my output capacitances of both devices and my power loop inductance. If I go down this direction and implement this converter, I can go up to pretty high frequency. Okay? it does not necessarily approach the ideal behaviors for switches that we've been talking about, these nice trapezoidal waveforms with low DVDT at turn on and turn off. But I can kind of push it in that direction by increasing CQ and CD. And as we looked at before with overlap turnoff losses, kind of depend on comparison of my output capacitance and my gate drain capacitance, along with my operating current and my gate driver current. So if I make those capacitances significantly larger than just the parasitics of the devices, then as I shut off this MOSFET, for example, the voltage across it is going to rise very slowly, and I can accommodate a slower gate drive without having overlap losses. I've gotten rid of my overlap turn-on losses and my CLSS losses by ZBSing everything. Okay. If I want to keep going higher and higher frequency beyond where I can get with the CBS multi-resonant buck, things start to look a little bit different, and it's actually going to loop back to what we had looked at previously in these AC link converters. So for the next few slides, I'm looking at a number of references of tens of megahertz and above demonstrated converters. So here, taken from one, the way they model the system, the way they look at it, is back to this kind of AC link setup. Right? So I have my inverter, then some passive network, and then my rectifier. The difference here is that this inverter is now generally going to be some kind of single switch type inverter. It's not going to be a half bridge or a full bridge. As I go up in frequency, I can't just assume that I have a half bridge that has a high side switch and a low side switch and it generates a square wave. All the parasitics are dominant. I no longer have a two switch network that I can say is connected without significant parasitics. Instead, this is going to look like a single transistor. The other issue with multi-switch networks is as I push up towards tens or hundreds of megahertz, I have a real hard time precisely controlling things like a dead time, things like a phase shift between different switches. It's hard enough just to get my 100 megahertz gate drive signal generated and sent to a device. But to be able to accurately control, okay, I want a 10 picosecond dead time between these two devices, we're going to have a lot of issues there. Okay. Then the other thing shown here, which look a little bit at control later in the lecture today, but once I start having a switching frequency of 100 megahertz, I'm going to have a real hard time developing closed loop control around this thing because I don't have analog circuitry where I can have very high gain, very good control, very, you know, flat gain response all the way out to 100 megahertz. I'm not going to be able to really push things in terms of my control. And I have behaviors of things like this multi-resonant buck. Let's see. A plot that'll show this. So here in my normalized voltage versus current plot, we've looked at before, this thing does not look like a voltage source, does not look like a current source. It has this kind of weird nonlinear behavior where what my converter does varies with everything. If my input voltage changes, if my load changes, it's going to change my conversion ratio, it's going to change the power, it's going to potentially push me out of ZBS. I don't have the ability, like I do with the buck converter, to say, okay, if I want a 2-to-1 step down, D is 0.5, and I need a little bit of regulation around that to take care of losses and transients, but I should be sitting right about there. Here, got this weird load-dependent conversion ratio that's going to be difficult to control because of all of its nonlinearity. Okay. So a lot of the work that has gone into the, you know, approaching or passing 100 megahertz has looked at just on-off control, where we, because of the high switching frequency, effectively operate this thing at a single operating point, one that we really like, at a power, you know, where we're comfortably in ZVF, and then if we want to drop the power, instead of continuing to run it and regulating to drop the power, we just duty cycle control it. So if I, I'll set it up so my output power is 100 watts. If I want 10 watts, I'll only turn it on 10% of the time, but it'll always be running at that nice operating point that I'm happy with. Okay. That's going to eliminate some of the benefits of high frequency, but if I'm at 100 megahertz and I turn it on 10% of the time, then I get 10 megahertz ripple, which is still pretty easy to filter. So looking at some of the approaches that have been taken, once we start going this high frequency, a lot of theory from RF amplifier design starts to come in and bleed into power electronics. So kind of the canonical topology used in RF for high efficiency and very high frequency inverters is this Class E amplifier. These classes are back from your signal amplifier microelectronics class. So Class A is a device that's always in saturation. Class B is a common drain. Class AB is a combination of the two. Class D would be a buck, traditional switch mode topology. Class E, something that's resonant switching type device, but still using the device as a switch, not as a common source, common drain amplifier, not in the linear region. That's why they call it Class E. This thing operates, this is just the inverter aspect of it. If I wanted a DC to DC converter, I'd add some matching network and some rectifier to it, but it's going to generate sinusoidal output voltages and currents here to some load resistance R. This schematic and waveform are taken from a paper here by Nathan Sokol. This is one of the more popular references on this Class E amplifier. It's a very good engineering-oriented reference, not very theoretical, but it's kind of a, if you want to design this thing, okay, pick some values roughly like this, and if your waveforms look like this, increase this capacitor. If your waveforms look like this, change this inductor. Very engineering-oriented. Because now this thing is heavily multi-resonant. And in fact, if we broke this apart into sub-intervals, the equivalent circuits are going to look very similar to the multi-resonant buck. We can apply the same type of analysis, but it's mathematically cumbersome. The way this thing works, this is a filter element. L1 is some large inductor meant to give me a DC current. So if I redraw this, it looks kind of like IL, drawing it with a BJT. Put a FET here, matter. Looks effectively like this. What I've got here is basically going to be generating kind of a square wave current here, where I've got this DC current. When the FET's on, it goes down through the FET. When the FET's off, it's going to go out through this network. This capacitor here is used to slow the change in voltage across this FET, so that when it shuts off, the voltage rises slowly, and I can have this nice slow turn-off loss case. These two elements are a high-Q resonant network meant to only look at whatever frequency I want out of this. If I want a 10 megahertz converter, I tune these to 10 megahertz so that whatever the waveforms are that are generated at the input to this tank, I only let the 10 megahertz component pass. That's all that goes to my load. When I look at the operation of this thing, the waveforms here, you can't see this, this is switch voltage and switch current, are pretty close to what I said I wanted when I was talking about ideally, what do I want out of a high-frequency switch waveform? I've got very low change in voltage as I shut off, kind of no overlap as I turn the switch back on. I do have very high peak currents and peak voltage stresses, right? Of high stress. But good, low, dV/dt at my switching times. A modification of this class E inverter, something called a class V2 inverter that's become very popular. Power electronics type applications, this thing has been demonstrated up to the tens, maybe low hundreds of megahertz. In RF amplifiers, we've seen this thing taken up to 20 gigahertz and above, very low power, but maintaining enough efficiency to operate without burning up in the gigahertz, tens of gigahertz range. Okay. So this is coming back from the RF domain where it's used really as a signal amplifier for radio transmissions. The class V2 inverter here is a modification coming from class F inverters, which came down from class E inverters. The basic concept is the main difference is here relative to the class E inverter I showed on the previous page. This is a second harmonic trap. LF is reduced slightly, so it's not a pure choke. It has a little bit of ripple. The second harmonic trap is used to eliminate my even harmonics and make my waveforms more symmetrical. When I look at my switch voltage here, notably asymmetric, by eliminating those asymmetries and really injecting some harmonics into my drain to source voltage, what I get is something like this, where I have notable harmonics present on top of my fundamental. The problem for analysis, I know this thing is truly multi-frequency. It's resonating at some frequency near the switching frequency and then some higher order component, which means my state plane analysis, even when I do these tricks of separating out my ramp from my resonant part that we did in the multi-resonant CVS buck, are not going to be helpful here because I truly do have two different frequency resonances going on. Okay? But the advantage of it is adding this additional high frequency harmonic kind of flattens out the top of my voltage waveform and gets us closer to these trapezoidal waveforms that we said we'd like. We'll have low dV/dt at the turn on and turn off, which is nice for switching losses, and I'm flattening out the top rather than going up to a higher peak, so I'm limiting my switch stresses. Okay. As they've shown, this was, I believe, which one am I taking the plots from? I think 110 megahertz, 500 watt converter that they showed up to 95% efficiency for. This thing, so if I want to make a DC to DC out of it, is using that same kind of Phi 2 inverter, matching it with a class E rectifier, just a single diode but matched with resonant elements to get, again, ZVS type behaviors. Magnetics are an issue up at the hundreds of megahertz. Many of you found that even on your little box design going into single megahertz, there's not a lot of great magnetic materials out there, and very hard to generate a low loss, very low value magnetic component. You add a ferrite, you get too much inductance almost immediately and way too much core loss. And in their implementation, what they did is these toroidal planar air core transformers, which are, rather than, as some of you looked at, planar winding, where I have a spiral and flux going perpendicular to the board, this is actually a toroid and the flux is circulating in the plane of the board to get the three inductors that they needed for this converter. Like I mentioned, gate drives are also an issue. So for their 110 megahertz converter, they had to also design a similar resonant type inverter architecture to be the gate drive. This is a self-oscillating network. They apply a DC voltage, let it oscillate at 110 megahertz to drive their main switch. A lot of times you come up with a design here that almost becomes recursive. You design your Class C amplifier, and I need a Class C amplifier to drive the gate of my Class C amplifier. But a lot of problems when you're going to this high frequency with generating those signals and getting them to the gate without significant ringing. So I can program an FPGA to generate 110 megahertz, but if I then try to push it over onto the gate and consider the parasitics of the gate and the loop inductance of sending it over there, I end up with enough ringing that it alters my behavior. I don't have switch on, switch off. I have switch ringing and changing behaviors. So these things are more complex. And we won't go too far into the RF theory of designing matching networks and kind of trying to shift the behaviors of these so we get optimal loading where we want it. But I do want to loop back to, okay, state plane analysis has probably fallen apart for this converter. How would I go about analyzing this thing in the deficit of some nice analytical tool? Okay. We're going to get there later in the course. We're going to use a technique known as sample data modeling using state space representation. But before I get there, I want to address kind of one more thing in the segment that we're on. And that is dynamic modeling, which we haven't looked at much yet. We've been looking really at steady state modeling of the converter. But if I want to know what are my transfer functions, how would I design control for this, particularly kind of before we get to this RF amplifier section where we're at too high frequency to control reasonably, I'm back at my couple megahertz CVS quasi-resonant buck. How would I design a controller around that? In order to do so, I need to know transfer function, the small signal model of the converter. Okay. So I'm going to do an example here. There's not going to be a lot of surprises. I think the fundamental theory that you guys already know from Intro to Power Electronics still applies, but it realizes in a bit of a different way. So I'm just reminding you here, I'm taking a step back. I'm going to the last converter we fully solved, which is the ZVS quasi-resonant buck that did not include diode capacitance, the difference between this and the multi-resonant buck. Okay. But we went through and we solved this thing out. This was our previous slide. The only thing I changed here is I put a nicer plot on top of my hand-drawn plot of the output characteristic for my conversion ratio versus JL, my normalized inductor current, which in a buck configuration by cap charge balance is the output current. So this is my conversion ratio versus load. Okay. So like we said on here, this thing is not a voltage source, not a current source. It's some kind of nonlinear thing. And if I wanted to know the small signal model of this, what I'm going to do is linearize around my operating point, right? I need a linear model for control. So if I was designing this for some steady state operating point right here, I would take my equations that describe operation, linearize them around this point, and I'd have my linear model that is a small signal representation around that DC operating point. Okay. And that model is now going to be different depending on what my operating point is, my relationship between conversion ratio and load, shown here, is going to vary with operating point. That's true of all converters, but it's going to be a bit more heavily dependent on operating conditions in these than it is in something like a buck. So in order to analyze this, we'll look back at this idea from before of extracting the switch cell from the parent PWM converter. And this really goes down the road of a technique called average switch modeling. Which is reviewed in Appendix B of the book. If you want a more generalized theory about why this works, you can look there. I'm just going to apply some of the results here. The basic idea of average switch modeling, we've been using average modeling heavily. You know, they're all experienced enough power electronics engineers that you're comfortable with averaging things, right? And we normally go this direction of volt second balance and cap charge balance, which is really state averaging, waveform averaging. The other approach is to do switch averaging, where I look at just my switch network, look at the voltages and currents on it, and average those. Gets me to the exact same point. Okay? So if I went through for my buck converter and wrote my equations for my average terminal waveforms here, taking my switch network out, got V2 and I2 as my output current and voltage, V1 and I1 as my average or my input voltage and current, and I looked at the average of those, what I know is that for a PWM buck, my average V2, which is this, the output voltage, is going to be equal to duty cycle times my input voltage. Average input voltage, right? I also need to, if I want a complete model, look at my average input current. Average input current is going to be equal to V times I2, my current going out. This would be the inductor current. It only goes to the input when the switch is on. Switch is on for duty cycle D. Okay, so this is my average behavior of this switch. So to get here, I've averaged. And then if I want to go to a small signal model, I linearize, right? This is now potentially some nonlinear thing. If my duty cycle is varying and my currents and voltages are varying, I have a product of two time varying terms that's nonlinear. So if I want to do a small signal model, I then linearize. And I can do that by doing a perturb and linearize approach where I replace all my averages with a DC value plus a small signal, and then delete all my higher order terms. I can do it with a Taylor series expansion where I only go to first order. Okay. Here, you guys will have no problem solving this. Top equation is going to look like V2 hat is equal to D V1 hat plus V1 D hat. I1 hat is equal to D I2 hat plus D hat I2. Old news, I take these equations. They're really giving me the same thing that I got out of doing my small signal linearization using volt second and cap charge balance. But I can put these model my switch, and I can put them into my parent converter. And if I look at my small signal model, this is from the textbook way back in chapter 7. What I have is my V2 being DVG hat plus VGD hat, which was this. Oops. And my input current being ID hat plus DI hat, that's this. Okay. So, Mr. Kostinet, we all know this. Why are you going back and belaboring this point? This average switch modeling, which allows us to abstract the switch cell from the parent PWM converter, going to be really useful now that we're looking at resonant switch configuration. So if I change this thing from a PWM switch cell to a ZVS quasi-resonant switch cell, now I can solve average behaviors of this thing and plug them into my parent PWM converter. After I average and then linearize, I now have my small signal model of a ZVS quasi-resonant bus. Okay. Fortunately, we've already done this because for a buck converter, V2 over V1 of this switch cell is the conversion ratio, right? Because all I've got afterwards is this LC filter that's only doing an averaging, and here I've mathematically averaged. So V2 over V1 was D, that's our conversion ratio M. So the buck converter is a special case. Where V2 over V1 is equal to M is equal to my actual DC output voltage divided by input voltage. So for this buck converter, I had this duty cycle thing show up in three different places. My DC operating point duty cycle determined the transformer turns ratio, and then I had my small signal duty cycle showing up in these two places. Okay. To get to my average model of the ZVS quasi-resonant buck, all I need to do is replace my D's with the M's that we solved before. Now, like I said, the buck is a special case where D is equal to M, so I can do this. More generally, if I was looking at a boost converter, M is equal to 1 over 1 minus D. What I want to replace is D hat with this V2 over V1. In the buck converter, V2 over V1 is M. In other converters, it'll be some function of M. Basically, if I can solve the conversion ratio, if I can solve my state plane analysis, I can find this V2 over V1, replace D with that, perturb, linearize, and get my model. Okay. So we solved this, I think, two lectures ago for the ZVS quasi-resonant buck. This was my conversion ratio, M. This was some function of JL, which is my normalized inductor current, and F. So if I look at this, I'm going to rewrite this as M is equal to 1 minus F over 2 pi times some function of JL, And this is already an averaged equation. The way we got this is by averaging the voltage at the switch node, doing volt second balance. So in order to get my small signal model, all I need to do is linearize. In normalized form, that doesn't help me so much. So what I want to do is look at what are the variables in here that are going to be changing. What are my time-dependent variables involved? Okay. So if I denormalize a couple of these variables, what I would have is that my M is equal to 1 minus FS over 2 pi F naught times some function of JL. JL is going to be IL over BG times R naught. And I have three things which are potentially time varying. So FS is going to be my new method of controlling this. I don't have a duty cycle incorporated here. I'm looking at switching frequency control. Then IL and VG are signals in the converter that potentially are time varying. Okay. So if I want to look at linearizing this equation, I'm going to have to do a Fourier series expansion with these three variables. Okay. So what I mean is that my M hat, as I linearize this, my small signal change in conversion ratio is going to be equal to the first order expansion, said Fourier earlier, I meant Taylor series expansion, excuse me, of this equation with these three variables. So mathematically, we write that as for FS, my term would be the partial of M with respect to FS, evaluated at the DC operating point, my linearization around the DC operating point, multiplied by FS hat. And for my other two variables, I'd have the partial of M with respect to IL, evaluated at DC times IL hat, plus the partial of M with respect to VG, evaluated at DC times VG hat. Start with this one because it's going to be nice and easy. So my partial of M with respect to FS evaluated at DC equal to, when I take this term and I take the partial with respect to FS, it shows up only here. So first term goes to zero when I take the derivative with respect to FS. I just get the rest of this stuff. This function, which is, to be clear, this thing is my F of JL, and I'm using this F notation just so I don't have to keep rewriting this whole thing. So my partial of M with respect to FS is just going to be that divided by 2 pi F naught. That's going to be and I'm going to have my DC, IL, and VG here. I'm going to be evaluating around the DC operating point. All this is going to be some constant value. Okay. For the other two, IL and VG, I'm now hopping into this function and needing to take a derivative of all that. What I'm going to do first is write expressions here using the chain rule, just looking at the derivative of this function. And on the next slide, we'll solve the derivative of that function. Okay. So the partial of M with respect to IL, I can write as the, so definitely this one term goes away. So I can then write this as the partial of M with respect to IL is going to be the partial of this F with respect to JL times the partial of JL with respect to IL. It's going to be the partial of, my notation's got a little bit weird here. So how I wrote this, I'm going to have to say this is F over 2 pi times the partial of F of JL with respect to JL times the partial of JL with respect to IL. Partial of JL with respect to IL, very easy to evaluate. That's going to be R0 over VG, right? JL is equal to this. So this is going to look like two pi R0 over VG times the partial of F of JL with respect to JL. So the derivative of this thing up here. Same thing for VG, partial of M with respect to VG, doing on time, it's going to be F over 2 pi, partial of F of JL with respect to JL, times the partial of JL with respect to VG, it's going to look like F over 2 pi, JL is this thing, partial with respect to VG is going to be IL over R0 VG squared, the negative sign, right? The derivative of this term with respect to VG is going to be negative IL R0 over VG squared, right? Okay, so the only thing I have left to evaluate is the partial of F of JL with respect to JL. It's going to be equal to the partial with respect to JL of all of this stuff. I'll grab that so I can write it on the next page. Do I have that somewhere? Not here. So writing this partial looks not fun, but it's actually not too bad. So we just go through and we'll go term by term. This looks like the derivative of this first term with respect to JL is going to be negative 1 over 2 JL squared. Pi, partial with respect to JL is 0. That term goes away. my arc sine, the derivative, this one we just pulled from the table, the partial with respect to x of arc sine of x is equal to 1 over root 1 minus x squared. So for this, I can take that and apply a chain rule that the derivative of arc sine of 1 over JL is the derivative of arc sine of x times the derivative of 1 over JL. That's going to look like 1 over JL squared for the inner derivative, then root 1 minus 1 over JL squared. My partial of JL is going to be 1. My partial of this square root thing is going to be the derivative of the outside, and applying the chain rule times the derivative of the inside, which is going to be 2JL. The partial of root x is 1 half times 1 over root x. And the inner derivative partial of JL squared is 2JL. Everybody good? Remember derivatives enough? Feel like if you had some time to sit down, you could have done this still? Okay, a derivative is this thing. You look at the line and the slope of the line. You guys, you're with me, right? Right.
There's a minus or like one minus, which is not very over the whole line. And the minus is one of that.
Sure. That. I agree with that. And I probably need to carry that through these two, right? Yeah. Thanks. Okay. So I'm here, I can simplify this thing. So my 1 half will cancel here. And I can combine my radical terms. The way I'm going to do that is I'm going to pull a JL squared out of this denominator. If I do that, this will become, now I've got JL over, if I pull a JL squared out, I get 1 minus 1 over JL squared out of this term. Everything else would stay the same. But that puts me over a common denominator on these two terms when my JLs cancel. So I'll get this looks like, gosh, 1 minus 1 over 2 JL squared plus 1 minus 1 over JL squared over root 1 minus 1 over JL squared. Almost out of time, I can then move my radical into the denominator, multiplying by this square root with a plus sign. Eventually, this is going to simplify out. This would be 1 minus 1 over 2 JL squared times root JL squared minus 1 over JL. Okay. What ends up not being that bad. Despite having this combination of trigonometric and linear and square root terms. So there's my partial. If I take this back, I now have my linearization of M by my arguments before. What I can do is just plug in for D everywhere. I'm going to replace D and D hat with my DC and small signal M for this CVS quasi-resonant buck. If I do that, this would become M hat. This would become capital M, my lowercase and uppercase M's don't look so different. So I'll note that that's DC. This will become M hat. Then M hat itself is a combination of three different things. It's some term times my switching frequency, some term times my output current, some term times my input voltage. On my small signal diagram, this is going to look like something times my input voltage. Something times this output current. The box. And something times my FS hat. These somethings are these partial derivatives that we just solved. Rather than trying to fit them into these boxes, I'm going to use the Book's notation. They're called KV for my gain from voltage, KI for my gain from current, KC for my gain from my normalized switching frequency. Okay. So before we conclude, what does this thing tell us? Unlike the buck converter where I just supplied in this duty cycle and it told the converter what to do, now I have significant dependence on operating point in terms of how my converter behaves. So I've got these inherent feedbacks. This isn't some hardware feedback. I'm not intentionally sampling IL and feeding it back. It's not my control model. This is just what my converter does. Okay. So if I change FS, it's going to change behavior, but that's going to feed back in from how the input voltage changes, how the output current changes, and alter the dynamics of my converter. So a much more complicated loop here, and that is this thing not being a voltage source or a current source, being something where the behavior of the converter depends heavily on the load. Okay. So a bit more complex to control. I know here the book uses mu as switch conversion ratio. Mu is equal to the average V2 over average V1 from my switch network. Mu is equal to M only for the buck. Okay. And that's a more general notation. What I did, because I'm a buck, I could just use M. If I wanted to do a different topology, I have to look at mu specifically. Okay. So, more complex, perhaps no surprises there. We already looked at the M versus J plot and saw that as we linearize this, it's going to have significant dependence on both input voltage and output current, not only my normalized switching frequency, which is these different curves. Okay. But it complicates the dynamics of the system. Okay. That alarm means it's time for me to wrap up. So we'll pick up there on Friday.